Welcome to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. You've likely heard of my guest today, Dr. Devin Brown, because of several books he's written related to C.S. Lewis. Plus, he was my guest for a special five-part series on his book, The Christian World of the Hobbit, in 2012. Today he's back with me because of a newly released biography on C.S. Lewis called A Life Observed. Welcome back to the show, Devin.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, now, let's deal with the elephant in the room. First, not only are there already a lot of biographies out on Lewis, this year alone there have been two others. What possible reason is there to add yet another?
Well, obviously, anybody who looks at the cover of my book, A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis, you know, the natural response is to ask, well, why another biography of Lewis, right? In 1974, Green and Hooper came up with the first one, 11 years after Lewis's death. And then, 1988, George Sayer, who had been Lewis's pupil and then good friend, gives us Jack. In 2005, Douglas Gresham wrote his own biography, Jack's Life, and Alan Jacobs produced The Narnian. And then this year, Alistair McGrath came out with Eccentric Genius, Reluctant Prophet, right? So, you know, in my preface, I say, you know, if you're going to do another one, that you either need to have some new and let's say significant material that's been produced. And, you know, I have Lewis's letters that some of the earlier ones didn't have. But more so than that is you have to take a different tack. And that's what I did. I focused on Lewis's spiritual journey. And by focusing on that, I was able to go way more into depth than other people have done. The other biographies, I would say, have been more or less what you would call a comprehensive biography. They tell a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And some of them, for example, you might learn who C.S. Lewis's grandfather was and when and where he lived. I don't do too much of that. It's not that you're not going to get some of the main details of Lewis's life. Of course you will. But I do focus on his spiritual journey. And by doing that, I'm able to go into depth on topics that, interestingly enough, no one's ever talked much about. And so I think whether people are learning about Lewis for the first time, my book tells all the basics and goes into depth in what I think is the most interesting part for me. Or if people are longtime Lewis fans, I hope and I believe there's something new that they'll learn from my book.
Now, in terms of arriving at your decision to take your approach, which again is the a spiritual biography focusing on his search, was it just from a marketing standpoint or other factors like you naturally saw his life this way and it was more natural? What contributed to that decision?
Well, I'll just say this. It definitely had nothing to do with marketing. I mean, sort of like Lewis and Tolkien, who had this agreement. Well, no one's writing the kind of books that interest us. We'll have to write them ourselves. That's the approach I took. I just tried to write a book that I would like myself. Lewis says the same thing in On Stories. He says some people think that he sat down and said, well, what kind of books do children like? Let me write one of those. And again, he said, no, I tried to write the book that I would like myself and assume that the kind of thing I like, other people might like. So it wasn't a marketing approach at all. It was just, I'm going to write, follow my own interests. I may be the first biographer who makes his living as an English professor, as Lewis did himself. And what this means is that more or less, I've been trained to think and write in somewhat the same way he did. For example, in Life Observed, there's all these epigrams. I mean, he has an epigram for each chapter. He has an epigram for the book. And English teachers like Lewis, and I'll put myself in that camp with great humility, like me, know that epigrams are really important. And while other people either say nothing about them or skip over them, I try to say, well, why would Lewis have included this? What is it trying to say? So I do a fair bit of that. The same thing by focusing on his spiritual life, those mystical experiences as a youth, Balder is dead, right? These strange feelings of longing, I try to unpack them a bit and go into some more depth by connecting them to, well, what Lewis tries to give up when he tries to give us those same kind of experiences. I will also say this, my authorial stance is the kind of stance that I like. And let me explain that for just a second, is there's been other biographies who want to be very objective and I would say almost scientific in their approach. Now, most of these writers clearly appreciated and admired Lewis, but they don't want to seem biased in any way. And in order to do this, they always sort of hold Lewis at arm's length. They don't get very personally involved in their story. And I'll just say they make absolutely sure to point out every real or imagined flaw that he may have had. This kind of gives them this objective, I'm not biased, you're getting the straight story from me. I hope I didn't go overboard in the other direction, but I didn't keep Lewis at arm's length. I really embraced him, and I tried to, I think it's clear that I tried to bring his amazing story to life with all the excitement that I believe it warrants. So that's the kind of story I like, where he really comes alive, not this sort of objective scientific approach. So anyway, there's different biographies out there, and probably different readers may like one or the other, or may like both for different reasons.
And in terms of telling your story, you divide your book into five chapters to represent the major periods in Lewis's life. An area I believe that many are not as familiar with is from what you have in your second chapter. So if you could highlight some of the material where you tell about Jack as a schoolboy and adolescent.
Yeah, I would say that other biographers haven't said quite as much about those early experiences. I find them quite interesting. You know, it was Wordsworth who said, as the twig is bent, so grows the tree, and the child is the father of the man. And it's clear to see how Lewis's early experience were connected to his later experience. And so I do things like where I point to that famous ending of Surprised by Joy, where it was all sea and islands, now the great continent had sunk. And then I point to that famous passage of Perelandra, right, where he is able to learn how to live in a world of sea and islands. His confidence and security doesn't come from living on a continent, but by having sort of the continent maker as his lord. There's a famous passage in Surprised by Joy. He tells how he became an effective believer when he was a young boy. And again, most biographers kind of skip over that, and maybe because I could identify with it or I found it more interesting. But, you know, he went through this idea of God as judge, you know, a bearded guy in a big white robe up in heaven with a big book. Big book and a big pencil, writing down everything you did bad in a little tiny eraser, right? Erasing it once in a while. And, you know, I think a lot of Christians go through that phase. And so did Lewis. Then he talks about his prayer life as a young boy. And I also found that fascinating and what his prayers were like. Again, I found his story to be like very unique, but also quite universal. You know, many of our stories, I would guess. And of course, I think that a lot of his writing later on prayer came from the lack of guidance he has as a young person. And this is something I think readers will really be amazed at, is how little guidance from adults he had. There was no one older, no one wiser to kind of point him on the right track. I mean, in my own life, I had great parents. I had a youth pastor. I had lots of counselors at camp who, when I sort of got astray into some sort of strange thinking, always, you know, set my feet back on the right path and were people I could go to for advice. Well, Lewis didn't have that. And I would also suggest that part of his vocation later in life was to provide that for all the people across the world who didn't have that.
Well, now, I don't always get a chance to read a book before I interview an author, but I have with yours, and I found it very enjoyable. When I was reading your preface, I, you know, understood, okay, you're looking at it from a spiritual biography, and so I kind of thought, okay, it's going to be about joy searched for, joy discovered, and joy lived. And in some ways, I didn't get that because I actually got that and much more. As Douglas Gresham, who did the foreword to the book, says, you not only tell about Jack, but you present him in a way that one feels they get to know him personally. Now, I set that up sort of to note in terms of, or my actual question is that a source that you use to help fill out his character, so to speak, is the essays. What parts about Lewis do you feel people miss by not reading his shorter works like the essays?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a great question and sort of part of a larger question, which is to say, when Lewis thought about something, it was in his mind and he was thinking about it and pondering it, turning it over, looking at it from this way and that. And you'll often find the same idea that comes out, whether it's in, you know, expressed in Narnia or comes out in Mere Christianity, it's going to be addressed in another work, in another format, because that's how he was. There's that famous essay that Barfield wrote about the three Lewises that later became the five Lewis, where he says that what Lewis thought about everything was somehow present in what he said about anything. And so as you turn from the letters to his diary, to his essays, to his apologetic works, to his fiction, you often find this same idea expanded on or gone into more depth or made more connections in another format. And so I'm not sure that the essays are different in kind from the other works so much as they provide yet another window into the same idea. And that way of tracing an idea from one format to another, I think, really gives us a rich and a balanced and a powerful expression of these ideas.
And one of the things that you do quite well is you weave from the different sources as you're talking about Lewis in the different periods in his life. You know, unlike other biographies that will like totally wait per se to discuss Narnia, you bring in how aspects that Lewis was experiencing in some ways he was able to write about various characters because of his own life experiences. So I think that's you know, one of the ways that you really do a great job with your book.
Yeah, let me talk about that just while you, mm-hmm. since you brought it up. I mean, English teachers have this famous saying, write what you know. And in the preface to Screwtape Letters, I think it's the 63 preface. Anyway, one edition he wrote a preface for. And he says, some people think that I got all these concepts about temptation, Screwtape Letters, from studying, you know, books and books of theology. He said, well, actually, I have a better source to learn about temptation, the human heart, right, my own heart. And so Lewis gives us a really good clue there that not just in Screwtape, but in all of his works, he's drawing on his own experience. He's writing what he knows. One of my goals was to try and connect his experiences with his writing about those experiences in a different format, a fictional format. So, yeah, I point to the early converts' experiences in Screwtape. And it's clear that Lewis is drawing on, and not merely in an autobiographical way. Certainly, he makes them fresh for that story, but certainly the source is his own experience as a new convert, for example.
We mentioned in the introduction about your book, The Christian World of the Hobbit, and people can go to essentialcslewis.com to find a link to that interview. I did an individual interview with you like this, and then we did a 5-part series. But you also wrote about, and I haven't yet done an interview with you, about your 3 books on the different Narnia stories. Could you give a brief summary of each of those books?
Yeah, and let me say a quick word about Christian World of the Hobbit, because it just struck me that when people look at my title, A Spiritual Biography of Lewis, Why Another Biography of Lewis, when they look at the title, The Christian World of the Hobbit, they go, what are you, nuts? You know, there's no churches, no Bible, no the word Christ, God is never mentioned in there. You know, it sounds like a typical English professor making something out of nothing, finding something there that really isn't there. So, yes, I understand people's skepticism. I really do try to be judicious in pointing out the Christian aspects that can be found in The Hobbit. Surely, Tolkien, it's undisputable, was a devout Christian all his life. He was very responsible for Lewis's own conversion to Christianity, and certainly he included his own personal faith in his fiction, and I try to say, and how did he do that, and where does he talk about it? In my 3 volumes of the Inside Narnia series, I'll clump them all together because the approach is the same in each one. I teach a class on C.S. Lewis and Tolkien at Asbury University here in Kentucky. And when I go around and speak, there'll be people that'll say, oh, I wish I could take that class. You know, and certainly I had the same feeling when I was in college. I wish I could have taken a class on Lewis and Tolkien. So at one point, I pretty much wrote up the kind of things we did in class when we read The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, and that's Inside Narnia. When we did Prince Caspian, I put that in Inside Prince Caspian. And then when we turned to The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the kind of discussions we had, going through the book chapter by chapter, stopping at whatever's interesting, analyzing some aspects, making connections, that's in Inside the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. So people that are interested in that kind of in-depth study, and don't get me wrong, not everybody is, but for people who would like to read what I kind of call a book about a book, right? I've got 3 of those about 3 books.
Going back to your current book here, A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis, there are often things that maybe are misunderstood or rarely known aspects about Lewis's journey. What do you feel that you bring out in your book that you hope people will realize more?
Yeah, and I don't know. I guess I'll start with misunderstood. Lewis's own faith journey as a young person is often glossed over or skimmed over or misunderstood. You know, you mentioned biographies. I don't know. I've got a shelf behind me with biographies, and I read all of them before I started. And there'll be people who think Lewis was a devout Christian when his mother died and he wasn't, or that he was never a Christian until he, in his 30s when he converted, but he was. So how exactly Lewis was a Christian and when he became a Christian, it's really there in Surprised by Joy. And maybe because my experience mirrored his a bit, I felt like I could make it clearer that, no, he wasn't a Christian when his mother died. He did become, as he called it, an effective believer. And what did that mean when he went away to boarding school? So anyway, I try and tease that out. And then the rarely known aspects, I got to tell you, Lewis in Surprised by Joy has these mystical and somehow hard to describe experiences of joy that are evoked by things today that, really, you're saying, really, Balder the Beautiful is dead, made it happen for you, or this biscuit tin that your brother Warney brought in somehow gave you a mystical experience. And so since I'm doing a spiritual journey, I really stopped to say, now, how might that work? Or what sense can we make of that as readers today? And I get that sometimes mystical experiences don't make sense for us. They're highly subjective, and we can't really follow what people are saying there. But I basically say, I don't think that's the case here. And I try to say, you know, yes, you've never been moved by reading this obscure Greek poet, but I bet you have been moved by reading this mystical place where the land and waters meet in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. So I try to say, here's how it worked for Lewis. Probably it's not going to work that way for modern readers, but it might work this way in this other kind of thing that he gives us. So anyway, that's a long-winded answer to the misunderstood or rarely known aspects question.
That was one of the things that I did especially enjoy about your book is that when, you know, I experienced that too when I read Lewis's original source. It's like, well, I can't quite grasp. I hear what he's saying, but I just can't see how he had that. But then when you bring in examples from his own writings, which does move me in the way that he describes, I understand that experience a whole lot more.
Well, good, because that's exactly what I was trying to do, to make sense of it for readers today.
Similar type question, but maybe from a different approach here, and that is, what are some key points you hope people will take away from Jack's faith journey?
Well, you know, that's a big question. Let me just give you a couple. One of the reasons Lewis was such a great proponent of the faith is because he didn't have faith for a long part of his life, right? And he, through his own spiritual journey, came personally, not in some sort of abstract way, to understand why modernism, or you could might call it modern secularism, or, I don't know, lack of belief in God just doesn't work, right? In his own life, he was teaching philosophy there at Magdalen, and he couldn't account for the good, the true, and the beautiful. And these were things that he found it impossible not to believe in, that some things were good and some things were bad, some evil, right? There was right and wrong in the world, and it wasn't just a construct. The other thing is the idea of reason or truth. He could not bring himself to believe that that was also a construct. And then finally, the idea of the experience of the beautiful, that wasn't some sort of mishmash of atoms and molecules, that there was really something beautiful there. And given those three things, the good, the true, and the beautiful, that he found to be absolutely in existence, not made up by man, he found that naturalism or modernism couldn't account for it. The other thing that I really hope people pull away is what he found through personal experience is that this kind of viewpoint just doesn't satisfy. He's got this famous line where he said, "My life was divided into two things. The things that I believed were true from modernism were grimy, dull, and, you know, empty. And the imaginative life that I knew wasn't true at that time was beautiful and shining." And so the idea of atheism doesn't work and it doesn't satisfy came from his own life. I guess the other thing that I hope people will take away is that, in one sense, Jack's story is unique, right? It's distinctly his own story. No one I know has lived like him and gone through his stages. On the other hand, it's a very universal story. All of us follow in his steps. That's to say that we were lost and struggling and in the end finally found and put back on the right path.
Thinking in terms of lessons we can learn from Jack, I can't help but think about another book you have coming out before the end of this year, and that is, it's not about Lewis, but his friend Tolkien, and that is Hobbit Lessons. We already made reference to, and you made some clarifying points about the Christian world of The Hobbit. Your new forthcoming book, Hobbit Lessons, how does it compare, or how does it differ from the other one?
My Lewis biography, Life Observed, is already out now. It's available Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, wherever people normally buy books. Hobbit Lessons will come out in October, and as most people listening will probably know, there's going to be, well, another Hobbit movie that comes out this Christmas.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, maybe people haven't heard, but yes, it's going to be huge. And so I live in a pretty vanilla world, right? Anyway, my publisher said to me, she said, there's a lot of people out there who aren't really as academic like you. And of course, I hang around with a lot of people who know Lewis and Tolkien and like reading books with footnotes. And she basically said, my editor said, she said, would you consider writing a very different version of the Christian world of The Hobbit for people that don't want to have citations and don't want to have a lot of references for just, she said, just for a general audience. And of course, my response was, that's how dumb I am. I said, well, I thought I was writing the Christian world of The Hobbit for a general audience. And she said, oh, no. So anyway, I think people often do this. Seemed like Michael Ward did it with Planet Narnia. She asked for a more general audience, a more less academic-y version of the Christian world of The Hobbit. She said something like your brother-in-law would read. And so all of a sudden I got it. So yeah, it's shorter. It's way more conversational. I have to say, I think it's way more fun. Although I like the kind of fun that are in academic books, but it's that other kind of thing. So, and perhaps in this, that sense, it also, it's not written for distinctly young people, but a younger audience probably would find it more accessible than the Christian world, The Hobbit. It's my first foray into that kind of writing. I found I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's much less formal, and like I say, I think a lot more fun.
Okay, well, look forward to that. And of course, if people are listening to this later than after it's just being released, then they can probably go ahead and find that book available now as well. Well, back to our primary topic here as we wrap up here. How would you summarize for readers why they should consider going to either their local bookstore or online to pick up your book, A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis?
Well, one of the greatest difficulties any biographer is going to have is the very different nature of his audience. Lewis scholars and Lewis fans who have read other biographies, who have written their own biographies, who have written scholarly pieces, Lewis experts are going to pick up A Life Observed and read it and hope to get something out of it. And then someone who's never read anything about Lewis, who maybe saw the Narnia films and would like to learn more about the guy who created Narnia, are going to pick it up. And let's just say that's kind of an impossible job to write a book both for where Lewis scholars and Lewis experts and Lewis fans, longtime Lewis fans, will learn something new, and also where novices who are reading their first Lewis book in their life will find it accessible. But I tried as much as I could to provide new information for people, well, like you, and I'm sure the kind of people who listen to you, something new to learn, and we've discussed some of those things. So I hope they're going to find new things that they hadn't learned before. And but I also hope, I really hope that there'll be lots of people who are just getting started with Lewis. And there's a whole generation of people that have now grown up watching the Narnia films, and they may only know Lewis through those films. And if they've only seen those films or only read the Chronicles of Narnia and are looking for a first book to pick up, I hope that they can pick mine up and it, hope it tells a story. It brings this wonderful person to life. And then I guess to conclude, I guess that both groups, old and new, will as do as I did, find Lewis's life story, his own journey, to be as fascinating, but not just that, also as inspiring as any story he wrote himself.
Well, I've already made some comments because of having an opportunity to read the book, and I think you do hit a good balance in terms of presenting Lewis not just facts, but people can get to know him, and those who are just new into Lewis, I think, will appreciate this approach as well as those who are already familiar with C.S. Lewis. Well, Devin, it's always good to have you as a guest. I appreciate you taking the time to be with me today.
Well, my pleasure. And can I add one last thing? I'm one of those people who often skips the preface and the foreword and starts reading just in chapter one because, well, why do you need the preface and the foreword, right? And I would just say you can skip my preface if you grab my book, but be sure to read the very lovely foreword by Douglas Gresham, which he was very gracious to write for me. I couldn't ask for a better foreword than the one he provided.
And for those one or two people who are familiar with Lewis but aren't familiar with the name of Douglas Gresham, there shouldn't be very many. Douglas Gresham, of course, is the stepson of C.S. Lewis. One final thing from me, and that is be sure to stop by EssentialCSLewis.com for other great interviews about Lewis, as well as other content. Again, that's EssentialCSLewis.com. Thanks again, Devin, for being with me.
My pleasure.